What we're going to do is give you a brief overview of what the Sanford Consortium is, and if time permits, which I think there will be, we'd like to engage in a discussion with you about this. So it's going to be an informal panel, Roger, I think, to do this. To start, I'll give you a little background on who we are. Roger said in his opening remarks that the stem cell on the Mesa has been in existence for, I think you said, 6 to 7 years, this meeting. Right.
Well, this is officially the sixth, but Larry and I, we were talking about the original launch of the Science Network, which was in 2004. So
this is our inaugural outing for the Sanford Consortium. Some of you may have been here yesterday when we had our grand opening, which is just across the street for our new building. I encourage any of you, if you have a chance during the break, to walk over and see the facility. It's a magnificent facility, and it's one that we think has special features which will promote stem cell research. It's an unusual concept, the Sanford Consortium, and I'll spend just a moment to tell you how we came into being. That it's different in the sense that it is a consortium of now 5 institutions that are working together. It started when Proposition 71 made available resources to put together physical facilities across the state of California. San Diego decided to take a somewhat different approach, and at that point, 4 institutions, UC San Diego, SALT, Sanford Burnham, and TSRI, decided to come together. This was really led by the scientists, a group of scientists represented by the 4 people here, but a larger group, decided they wanted to live and work together in a common facility to do stem cell research. This was supported by the institution leaders of the then 4 and 5, La Jolla Allergy and Immunology Institute joined us just last month to make the 5th institution. Decided that this was going to be a useful approach to doing collaborative research. And we were invaluably supported by a group of community leaders who made this possible. Occasionally, as you might imagine, we would get off course and people from the community would help us to understand the correct direction to go. So it's been a real collaborative effort from the point of view of led by scientists, supported by our institutional leaders, and also by strong support from the community. None of this would have been possible without the citizens of California who voted for Proposition 71 and made available a very generous grant to get this started. But that wasn't enough. We wouldn't have gotten over the hump if it hadn't been for a very, very generous individual who happens to be here at the moment, Denny Sanford, who was kind enough to make the lead gift for this and lend his name to that. That is really what pushed us over the hump and made it possible for us to have the Sanford Consortium. The University of California, San Diego was extremely generous and gave us this spot of land next to the Salk Institute. And we have a rather nice view when you walk over to see that. That led to an interesting dialogue among the scientists is whose offices get to be closest to the golf course, to the glider port, to all of the important things in life. So it is an interesting organization. Something to recognize is that we are not a 6th institute. We're really a collaboratory. We are... solely owned, if you will, by our 5 partner organizations. And we're led by a scientific steering committee, and I'm going to turn it over to Larry in just a moment to give you an idea of how the science has been organized. For those of you who might be interested, we're a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. We're led by a board of governors, a board of directors, which has the institution presidents on that, and then 4 members of the community serve as co-chairs for this. The only 2 employees of the organization are myself and Louis Kaufman, who is the vice president. What we've tried to do is to not duplicate anything that exists in our partner organizations and take advantage of the infrastructure that's already available there and to keep it to a very science-focused organization and one with a minimal administrative overhead. All of the faculty in the Sanford Consortium hold primary appointments in their participating member organizations, so we don't own any faculty in this institution. And the underlying concept, which I think you'll hear from the speakers today, is that this is a collaboratory, is the word that we really like to use. It's a major collaborative effort for us. It's a collaboration among institutions, as I said. It's a collaboration among scientists, and it's a collaboration across disciplines and across the Mesa. So let me stop with that brief background and ask Larry Goldstein. Larry, if you might tell the group a little bit about what the scientific agenda is. How did you guys go about deciding who's going to get to be in this magnificent facility, and a little bit about what we're going to do?
Great. Thank you, Ben. So thank you all for coming this morning. Hopefully what I have to say over the next few minutes before I speak, but before I turn it over to my partners in crime here, will be interesting. We had an interesting challenge in front of us when we started to think about organizing the science and the consortium. On the one hand, there's a tremendous need for scientists and clinicians to work together and to work across disciplines in order to solve problems in human disease and medicine. On the other hand, many of us know from experience that telling a bunch of academic scientists what to do is going to end in utter disaster. And that, in fact, in many cases, the very best science comes from individual initiative and curiosity and people simultaneously together identifying a problem to work on and then solving it because of an identified opportunity. So in some ways, you can think of the goal of the Scientific Steering Committee as, you know, trying to put together organized chaos, or perhaps another way of thinking about it is, you know, the herding cats phenomenon, where you're trying to get all of these individual academics who like to work on their own and only work together when there's a real opportunity to do something unique to come together in teams to solve problems moving ahead. So that's the experiment we've embarked on, and that was our challenge in thinking about how to staff not only this building, but then how to leverage off of that building to enhance many other programs across the Mesa for scientists who don't necessarily live inside the Sanford Consortium building. So the way we went about this was to identify a few scientific foci where we felt that there was not only existing strength on the Mesa, but where we could leverage off of that strength and bring either additional strength or grow into a new area. And the areas that we felt really had the greatest strength were in neuroscience and neurodegenerative disease, oncology and related disorders, and in cardiovascular related diseases because of strong efforts that we could work off of where scientists were moving into stem cell approaches to these problems. But that we also recognize that one of the things that's in the water of San Diego that makes this place so unique and so wonderful to work in is the ability to transcend disciplinary borders. And we had a strong recognition that what we wanted was unusual technologies to help leverage our efforts. And so we wanted to have folks who worked in genomics, informatics, cell differentiation technologies, and very importantly, engineering, to be part of the mix so that we could bring these technologies and leverage them in each of these core areas. So, of course, one can sketch out these scientific areas, and there are tremendously important problems and disease in every one of them, running from leukemias to breast cancer to heart disease to neurodegenerative diseases, such as those Rudy mentioned, to many, many others. And then the question is, how within those themes do you get people to come together and work together? And that's where we hope we've worked our magic that we'll be exploring in the coming years. Because the search image, if you will, for the scientists that we've recruited in some cases or helped facilitate in other cases to move into the consortium building is a combination of self-selection and our identification of these individuals. And the criteria, if you will, are, of course, first and foremost, excellent scientists, folks with either a wonderful scientific track record from our institutions or who are young but have potential for substantial future progress. The goal always to have these people do their best work in the coming years in the environment that we're trying to put together. But there's a second feature of these people. Not everybody who's an outstanding scientist necessarily wants to work together in a collaborative, sharing, interdisciplinary environment. It really isn't for everybody. But for those for whom it's the right thing, it can be a wonderful thing. And so we went through a process of trying to figure out not just who the right personalities were, but what the right mixtures of personalities were in terms of getting people together, co-locating, and then trying to facilitate the future by having folks who wanted to work together, not necessarily knowing exactly how they were going to work together, and then putting them in proximity, and then, as I like to think of it, getting the heck out of their way to let them be what they're going to be and do great things. Because at the end of the day, I think most of us up here, all of us up here, recognize that the best science doesn't come from a top-down approach. We collectively do not have all the best ideas. We want to get people who have better ideas than we do and get them in there working together. And so that's really been our approach. The kinds of projects that you will see working there are stem cell approaches to different sorts of cancers, looking for drugs in some cases, identification of cancer stem cells in other cases, developing cell-based therapies for Lou Gehrig's disease, looking for drugs for schizophrenia and autism and Alzheimer's disease, looking for mechanisms of these disorders, and trying to really marry the very best inquiry-driven, basic mechanistic science, but with the goal of translating as rapidly as we possibly can to clinical application. And so I sat down this morning and I did a quick tally, and I asked the question, okay, what fraction of our population of PIs did we end up with who are MDs and who have the capacity to actually move things to the clinic someday? And it turns out a third of our investigators have MDs. Some of those have PhDs, and then there's a bunch of us low status pure PhDs, such as myself, who just, you know, try to do whatever we can do, I suppose. And I think that really will facilitate these processes, because my own experience from collaborating with clinicians over the years is, even if I myself am not in the clinic, knowing what the problems are help you understand how you might best drive your initial scientific investigations. So that, in a nutshell, is how we put this beast together. It's been an interesting experience thus far, and now it's our job to actually bring Denny's investment to fruition, the people of California's investment to fruition, and the hopes of all of us and all of you to some interesting conclusion, both scientifically and, of course, clinically in the coming years.
Great. Thanks, Larry. Just to put a codicil on that, I would encourage you, if you have a chance at a break, to walk over and see the building, because it was purpose-built really to promote collaboration. It's got a number of unique features, lots of glass in it, lots of open spaces, rooms that promote interaction. The stairwells are designed in such a way as to promote interaction at the vertical as well as the horizontal level. And so it's an intriguing building, and you may want to just take a look at it.
Well, I guess the thing I'd add is it's the first building I've been in where you cannot get from point A to point B without walking through somebody else's space. So if you're a shy, retiring individual who doesn't want to bump into anybody, the Sanford Consortium building is not the place for you, because you will be interacting with people, and that is absolutely intentional. You can't avoid it. It's a great design for that.
Thanks, Larry. Rusty, maybe I could get you to say a few words about the cores. One of the things that we hope will also promote collaboration is having a central set of cores that are useful to the people in the building, but to the wider body of investigators across the Mesa. Rusty?
Yeah, so cores were a little bit of a challenge because we're four institutes or five institutes now that have come together, and there's no real central facility or no employees other than Ed, so we didn't have people running the cores. So how do you do this? So the ground state was no cores. What you do is use the cores in your own institutes, and that way we just solve the problem. But of course, as many of you are scientists know, there are certain large pieces of equipment and facilities that you really need to have next to your lab, and you can't afford to pay for it yourself, and it's cost effective to have it run in an aggregate way. So we sent out a survey to all the members of that were going to be PIs in the building and asked them, what did you absolutely have to have, piece of equipment or facility in the building, but you couldn't pay for, or you couldn't afford. It was an elaborate survey of what did you need to have, but it didn't need to be in the building. What would you like to have? This sort of range of questions that we asked people. And I came back and it was pretty telling that there were certain things that we absolutely needed to have in the building, or a large majority of people needed to have in the building. But there were many things that they needed, but they didn't really need to have in the building. And we had pretty good facilities on the Mesa. So we organized a group, and we got together and brought together a lot of the core leaders from these two different institutes to give us an idea of what existed on the Mesa. And this isn't really finished yet, and finally, but we're actually pretty excited about the idea that we're beginning to learn what each of the four institutes have as cores, five institutes have as cores, working, and which ones work effectively. And so we took the best of those, and in the cases where we needed to have in the building, we asked those individuals to be the leader in helping to devise a micro core or a related core to the one that existed off campus, or in some cases, help develop a new core. And in the end, our hope is that what we'll really do is organize all the cores in the Mesa, so that the view of this is going to be you're going to log on to cores on the Mesa, and you'll have some idea of what it is that you want to do, some microscope that you're interested in having, some high-throughput screening that you'd like to have. Go to your index, pull it down, and you'll have some options. There'll be two or three places on the Mesa that have something that you want. There'll be prices which will be matched, and we're working on that right now, which is kind of interesting. How do you manage overhead costs between different institutes? But believe it or not, we're actually making some headway on that. But the advantage will be, I mean, for the working scientists, for the postdocs and students, is that you'll actually be able to have a location where you can find out what instruments are available within walking distance or bicycling distance and go use it. So that's a spinoff, and we're working towards that. And the various institutions that can see that this is going to be cost-effective on the one hand, in the sense that we'll try to reduce redundancy, but also if there's some consensus that's building on what we need, new instrumentation that we need, we could merge together and buy that piece. So that philosophically is the direction we're going. Obviously, we had to get some cores going already. So first and foremost, we recruited a very functional stem cell core, growing cells, harvesting cells from UCSD. And those individuals that ran it and used it most effectively are moving into the building full force and with their fully functional operation on a recharge basis. We also recruited a viral vector core that existed at the Salk, which will still have its recharge base in the Salk, just like the UCSD stem cell core will have its recharge base based in UCSD. But they'll be right next to each other, working hand in hand. And they both work together to design the space, acquire equipment. And our hope is that this will be all freestanding eventually. We'll have a histology core, a microscopy core, which will focus primarily on live imaging, live tissue imaging. We realize that everybody else could get fixed tissues analyzed either in their home institutions or in their own labs, so we try to think about the high-end things. And each one of these core regions had a committee that evaluated what was needed. We also, and maybe I'll ask Ed to talk about this, we got really ambitious about wanting to have imaging. Imaging is going to be crucial for the future, and especially live imaging, live animals, humans, and watching where the cells go or monitoring where drugs are going. So we invested in magnetic resonance imaging, functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, which is already in place at the building, and we have potential and plans for PET, SPECT, and we're still evaluating how to run that effectively. But I think what it harkens to is the idea that we don't want to do just the things that we're doing now. We're trying to think ahead about technologies that we hope to get to or that might be useful in our collaborations with industry and in translation. I don't know if you want to say something about where we are with with that.
But just a word on the in vivo imaging that, thanks to CIRM, we were awarded a portion of our grant was to build out about 8,000 square feet of space and in vivo imaging capability. Exactly how we're going to do that, as Rusty said, is a work in progress. But I think a take-home message for all of you is that we would like very much for this to be not only something that the Sanford Consortium uses, but everyone across the Mesa and ideally across the region would be a part of this. And we're going to welcome in investigators from other institutions outside of our own and with industry as well. And we have some interesting opportunities to design this in a way that will make it a multi-user facility, and access to this very expensive imaging capability is not something most of us can do on our own. And so in addition to MRI, we hope at some point we might have a cyclotron and ability to generate novel ligands to use and looking at cells in vivo as well as PET, SPECT, CT, X-ray, the ultrasound, IVUS, all the routine technology.
We'll have a genomics core as well, trying to find out where the bottlenecks are in not so much not so much in generating the data as much as in preparation libraries, things of that nature, where we may have some special expertise in the building, and then at the other end of data analysis, which is where a lot of the backups are. So we're going to try to develop that in the building itself with some of the expertise that we have there. Finally, we're going to be fluid and think about new technologies, new ideas as they come along. And so if we need to drop some core and add another one, I think we'll do it, since we're not going to be invested in it necessarily from inside, but rather taking the best from the outside. My real hope here in being involved in the cores part was that not only would it be good for the building, but it would be this is a unique opportunity for the Mesa to communicate with each other and not have redundancies, as much redundancy as we have now, find out what everybody else has, and then work cooperatively to move more aggressively towards developing new cores, new technologies as a group.
Thanks, Rusty. I think something that comes out from both Larry and Rusty's presentation thus far is that an underlying theme in doing this has been the building of consensus. And it's not always an easy way to go forward when you have to get a consensus, but I think we've had a modicum of success with that, and the cores are a good example of that. Is that it was the investigators who got together and said, this is what we really need to do this, and it's been an interesting experience. Quite possibly the U.S. Congress could learn something from this that I don't seem to do that very well. Next, Evan, if I might get you to say something about the translational component, since that's the theme of our whole conference today and how we hope to do some things there.
So I'm going to spend a few minutes just talking about how the consortium hopes to realize its translational mission. And I should say, from the very beginning when we wrote the grant to CIRM, and in CIRM's wisdom, they insisted that the building have three components: basic science, translational biology, and then a clinical component. So this was always in our mind. And when you think about it, this is why we actually do what we do. You heard a lot about this yesterday, that we do the science because ultimately we care about the patients. We also realized that translational medicine really takes a village. It needs to be a collaboration on multiple levels. And I think you've heard a lot about how the consortium really is a collaboratory. So it was not only a collaboration between institutions, but it was also a collaboration between organ systems, and not just between organ systems, but also between disciplines and approaches to those organ systems. So developmental biology and engineering and bioinformatics and non-hypothesis discovery research, translational research, animal modeling, simple animals, things of that sort. So when you realized everything that was required to do translational research, we recognized that not all of that could go into the same building. But we then also realized that that didn't need to be that way, that one could have resident and non-resident programs, and then that the collaboratory was simply the physical home of a much broader consortium. And this broader consortium would include the hospitals and the clinics and big pharma and the biotechs and even those working in simple animals or systems that one would not even think of as being part of the stem cell mission. The ones, as Larry indicated, that we decided would be resident within there, and this was done with no any bias in any sort, was that neuroscience, cancer, diabetes, engineering, biomaterials, reproductive medicine, cancer, as I mentioned, and would really have major homes within the consortium. And within neuroscience, because neuroscience is so well represented, so heavily represented on the MESA, that would include brain tumors, spinal cord injury, ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, stroke, lysosomal storage diseases, aging, things of that sort. So once we had had a sense of what this consortium represented in the field of translational medicine, we then had to figure out, well, how do we approach translational medicine? And I think, as Ed indicated, it was an immediate consensus that translational medicine still had to be mechanistically based. It had to be rational, evidence-based, because that's how you make the best progress in translational medicine. So when things work really well the first time, you could say, well, you don't really need to know the mechanism. But we know that's not how things work. Usually, they work a little bit. And then you want to know how to make them better. And the only way you're going to know how to make them better, how to troubleshoot, is to understand what it was you were doing. So from the very beginning, it was decided that even our translational mission would be very heavily rooted in basic science and in understanding mechanisms. It was also recognized that translational medicine is not just a single approach. There is no silver bullet. It's all multimodal. So that is why, for example, the engineers and the cell therapists and the gene therapists all get together. So for spinal cord injury, there's a lot of work on taking cells and combining them with scaffolds to provide support, provide templates. Even as we do drug discovery, we recognized we needed really first-rate chemists, medicinal chemists, to help us understand the leads and perfect the leads. So then how are we going to facilitate translation in the building? And I think you heard about some of the cores that will really kind of facilitate and augment our ability to do really good translational medicine. So one aspect of translational medicine is transplantation. We planned to have, as you heard, really first-rate, amazing imaging facilities. If our vision's realized, this will be the premier imaging facility probably in all of academia and definitely within the field of regenerative medicine and stem cell biology. We knew we needed really good animal models that could be assessed in terms of their behavior and their metabolism. We knew we needed a lot of banks of starting cells to make iPS cells and then the iPS cells themselves. And we needed really excellent drug discovery infrastructure, which I think we have in place. We even plan to have a cyclotron, as Ed indicated, because we knew that we would need to see the fate of drugs and what their metabolism might be, in addition to looking at the cells. We also recognized that translational medicine was not just being insular, but that we needed to educate the public as to how good translational medicine is done. And I think that presence of medical tourism and a lot of what we hear indicates that the public doesn't understand entirely how you need to do translational medicine. But we could teach them, and education was part of that mission. It was also a place, because this is such a wonderful place to get together, that this would be a magnet for clinicians to come, for us to talk to them, for us to interact with them, teach them how the basic science may apply to their clinical problems, interact with the companies, Big Pharma, who actually make the drugs possible and make them accessible to the public. The occupants themselves, as Larry indicated, are exceedingly diverse. There are basic scientists, there are physician scientists, there are people in the building that you would maybe not consider to be your classic stem cell biologist, but they're important to the mission. And I think it's very telling that a good percentage of the CIRM disease teams are actually now represented or will be represented in this building. So kind of you heard a little bit about both yesterday, and I think you'll hear throughout the entire next 2 days, when will the translational mission of stem cell biology be realized? And I think I'm going to say that we are already seeing an impact, and that's an impact even independent of a cure, quote-unquote, or even clinical trials just marching along. I think that stem cell biology, even in a translational sense, has kind of changed the way we think. So it is now accepted that there is plasticity in organ systems. Well, that's the result of the stem cell field for the past two decades. It's accepted, for example, thanks to investigators right here in this room, including Rusty, that enrichment and enhancement and exercise and things of that sort will enhance this plasticity and create better neurogenesis and things of that sort. Well, that's stem cell biology. And if you look at what is being done now for Alzheimer's patients and Parkinson's patients, it's exercise and enhancing their cognitive activity. Well, that's stem cell biology. You've heard from Katrina that we now have novel drug targets. Well, that came out of stem cell biology. Or that bone marrow transplantation is actually more effective with less graft versus host disease because we're starting to use umbilical cord cells. Well, that comes out of stem cell biology. So we understand new factors that would never have been understood, or genes that never would have been understood if it hadn't come from understanding stem cell biology and being able to deliver some of these now by stem cells to pathology. So I would argue that we're already making an impact. We're already starting to realize our translational mission. And hopefully it'll accelerate. And we will have, you know, the more traditional, classical clinical trials that lead to real cures. And I'm going to end with one last comment, because it was mentioned before and it's going to be a recurring theme about what happened to Geron mean? And what is that? What are the implications for that in translational stem cell biology? And I somewhat have a little bit of a different take than what other people might have. Those of us who remember campaigning for Prop 71 heard, apart from the right-wing arguments, we heard a lot of arguments, even from the more liberal constituents, that this is something that shouldn't be done in academia or done in the public sector. This should be done in the private sector, and that Prop 71 was simply going to be welfare for biotech companies. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm just going to end here. Well, you said 10 minutes, and it's exactly 10 minutes. So the point that I wanted to make is that if we do that, market forces will influence the patients that get treated, and that needy patients need to be taken care of where you don't worry about the bottom line. And that's what academicians and the public sector needs to take care of. So that's why we do what we do, and that's why I think CIRM is around and why CIRM funded us. The good thing is that even though the Geron trial was truncated, obviously, they did do a service for us in giving us a regulatory route. So we actually know now how to start navigating through the regulatory route there as we start getting closer to cures. So.
I think next, Marty, if we could ask you to say a few words about the interdisciplinary nature, what the consortium is going to be, and how we're trying to put that together.
Well, the danger in following four such shy, retiring individuals that most of what I'd want to say has already been said, so I'll make my comments very brief. I think, you know, the absolute key to translating translational science into the clinics is interdisciplinary collaborations, the kind of things that the NIH is increasingly recognized by making more of these collaborative grants available. CIRMA certainly recognized that. That's certainly something we're going to see in this building. You know, stem cell translational science is not simply developmental biology on steroids. It requires, you know, understanding basic fundamental underlying mechanisms, but then taking these and identifying and isolating a population of cells you then want to put into a patient, to characterizing these cells very carefully, to sort of preparing them for transplantation, and ultimately putting them into the patient. And each of these require interactions between a variety of disciplines, which include not only developmental cell and stem cell biologists, but our colleagues in biomedical engineering and the clinics. I think this building is a remarkable, this collaboratory is a remarkable opportunity to bring together these sorts of people. And I think the key to this building, what distinguishes it from many other sort of traditional departments or facilities like this, is the ability to leverage off of the interinstitutional strengths that we have. I think the building brings together in it people from a variety of institutions which have collectively a remarkable level of strength. And I think we're going to see, as everyone has pointed out, the interaction between the biomedical engineers, the computational scientists, the stem cell biologists, and the clinicians. I think within a mile radius of the building are colleagues with which the 30-some-odd individuals in the building themselves interact with on a daily basis. And by virtue of the type of building we've constructed, we'll bring these people over to interact quite regularly. I think the building and the collaboratory itself recognizes the value of the sense of community, and as others have pointed out, it's something that's really unseen anyplace else. I'm not aware of any other place in the country where such august institutions have sort of volunteered their members to put together to one facility which will help take something new and novel to the clinics. I'll just finish up by saying I think that, you know, one can think about challenges that face us by translating this into the clinics and the absolute requirement for interdisciplinary collaborations by looking at my own field, for example, vision science. You'll hear later this afternoon about an ongoing clinical trial which takes a cell type called an RPE cell and puts into patients which have a disease, macular degeneration. The dry form of this disease afflicts over 15 million people in this country. We have absolutely nothing to offer these patients today. However, with the generation of ES-derived RPE cells and now iPS-derived RPE cells, we have the opportunity to think about individualized therapy or autologous grafts. However, deciding what type of cell best to put in, how to distinguish these cells from one another, and how to ultimately put them into the patient are challenges which are going to require absolute interactions between people from different disciplines. The concept of omics, you know, using metabolomic and genomic, as Rudy has pointed out, is absolutely critical to determining what is the level of cell function that we need to put into the patient. How do we put them in? Is the disease environment different than a normal tissue environment? All these things will come from facilitated interactions between people from different disciplines. In the interest of time, I'm not going to tell anything this audience doesn't already know, other than say that this building really is a remarkable opportunity, even as a scientist participating in the conceptualization, the planning, and structure of this building. I don't think any of us have ever had the opportunity to participate so thoroughly, and I think just as we participated in the creation of this collaboratory, I think we're all going to now take it to the next level and see this sort of go through to the clinical application in advancing what we understand in science. It's a remarkable journey.
Introduction, you'll have a sense for the excitement, the creativity, and the diversity of the types of people and the programs that are going to be in the Sanford Consortium. I think in the remaining 15 minutes, what we'd like to do is engage all of you, and if you have questions or comments about what we're up to, we would welcome your input, and I see one hand up. Can we do that, Roger?
Sure, I can do that. My hand around, of course. Okay. Couldn't wait for your panel.
I was very impressed with the whole idea that it has to be collaborative, but I just wanted to sort of ask that as an extension of what Dr. Yenish pointed out a little bit earlier, that what he thought was going to be first was using cells as an in vitro model and screening with small molecules rather than thinking of cells only for therapy. And I was wondering in this consortium and this collaboratory, what is the sort of infrastructure to be able to do that kind of activity?
Larry, do you want to?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll launch and then others can chime in. I mean, I think there are two pieces to that. One is making sure that, you know, we actually have enough tissue culture capacity to support what is just an overwhelming burden of tissue culture. I mean, it's interesting. The building was designed before 2007, what I sometimes think of as PY, pre-Yamanaka. And so we have a fairly large vivarium, and then we designed in an amount of tissue culture that I thought was complete overkill in terms of the number of hoods. Now, since 2007, the amount of tissue culture we all do has gone up exponentially. We do a little bit less animal work, and so we're finding that we're having to put more hoods in, to our amazement. And so we're trying to keep up with that challenge on the one hand, just to have enough capacity. The second, maybe the more important issue is that I think we all know, those of us who've had who've done work in industry with drug development, that there's a big difference between an assay or an observation that will work on a bench driven by a graduate student or a postdoc, and then something that can be adapted to the robotics and fluidics that allow you to test anywhere from 50,000 to 500,000 compounds and then drive a MedChem program. And so you got to develop stable assays. And I think what we're trying to put in place, and is still something in the discussion phase, is an assay development core. And we're still talking about exactly how to do that. But scientifically and medically, there is another valley of death that is not just the financing. It's the valley of death between the observation that a graduate student can get to work 8 out of 9 times and therefore is reproducible and true, but is not operating at less than 5% variation on a well-to-well basis, for example. And so I think that kind of infrastructure we're trying to put in place, because there are multiple terrific screening facilities around the Mesa, both in academic institutions and in the private sector. And of course, La Jolla Allergy and Immunology has this wonderful RNAi and shRNA screening center set up, so that those of us who are interested in not just looking for drugs, but understanding disease pathways, can potentially do screens on disease phenotypes to look for drivers of disease phenotypes. So I think, in addition to scientific excellence, we're trying to put some of the actual physical pieces in place to enable exactly what you're talking about.
And, Mahendra, to follow up on that, I think as important as it is to have in vitro systems, at the end of the day, if the goal is to put this into a patient with a disease, the diseased microenvironment is entirely different than anything we've created in a test tube. Having said that, again, I think only serves to illustrate how important it is to have an interdisciplinary collaboratory such as this, where you have engineers who could help engineer substrates which make more closely approximate the disease environment these cells will encounter. You can take the same cell, put it into three different environments that could behave entirely differently. So it's got to extend beyond just the concept of growing something in a dish.
I think that there's another piece, and as we begin to model human disease, I think we're quickly becoming clear that we need to be able to differentiate these cells into cells that authentically represent the cells that are diseased in a dish. And that modeling itself is a scientific enterprise. It's really a lot of developmental biology, functional biology, which is very attractive, I think, to young people right now, is to apply what we've learned over the last 40 years, for example, in developmental neurobiology to human ESL to figure out how to make, pyramidal cells or granule cells or how to myelinate cells. So these are fundamental questions, but then they become the ground phase for modeling human disease, because we believe anyway that you need to have them. I do believe that getting and using those then to translate into an assay, in some way you can reduce it in a way you could screen, but there is this intermediate stage where there's still a lot of biology that has to be done to understand how to get these cells down that direction, which I think is very exciting and attractive to a lot of basic scientists that are turning to the field. I also think that drugs derived from these kinds of assays will be the most, the first and most effective therapies that we'll see, I think.
Yeah, just to kind of follow up on it, because I think, Rudy, you made a very important point in one of your slides about the steps in which we can use stem cells as to disease in a dish, but conventional therapies, so small molecules, biologic, toxicity, for example, screening with these cells. We've had some interesting conversations with people in the private sector about ways we might collaborate with them. And then the idea of having something like a cyclotron on site is, could we use small molecules as well in designing therapies on the way to having replacement therapies down the line? So we very much embrace that concept that you and Rudy have talked about of multiple ways to intervene. Yes.
Yes, following up on the question or the comment on SA Development Core to be implemented, there was also the mention of an iPS cell bank. So I was wondering whether there is a plan also to put in place an iPS reprogramming core facilities.
Well, for the cores, that was not... Well, we've certainly talked about it. There are so many organizations right now that are thinking about building iPS cores that I think for us as a small institute, you know, to do that on a large scale doesn't make sense. I won't even go into the number of committees that are sitting around trying to plan how best to do this, and fundamentally, you know, which is the best method for inducing iPS versus how do you store the cells? You know, Rudy's talking about all these stoichiometric differences between how you make iPS cells one way or another. That debate hasn't been settled yet. So probably rather than thinking about iPS banking, it'll be more of cell banking. Coriell is working this out. Other places are working this out. I think some way to get the MTAs worked out so that they move more quickly. I think I'd reach out from the from our small institute and place this in the hands of larger organizations to think about the broader issues of MTA and big storage, and that I don't think is something we're going to take on, or at least I wouldn't recommend.
I can elaborate. I think it's important to recognize that the consortium is more than what's in this building. The consortium is Mesa-wide. So with regard to answering Mahendra's question and answering your question too, that, for example, our own particular institute has taken on the mission of trying to have a large iPS bank of both starting cells and of generating them. But that even if it's not housed in the building, that is accessible to the entire consortium. So the consortium is Mesa-wide, and that will be accessible.
Question up here.
I think there's a...
Yeah, so this is Bert Lubin. I'm at Children's Hospital in Oakland, California, and I would...
Good luck. Good luck.
Yeah, I think the way to do that is to ship them some of our water.
That wasn't the question, but as a CERN board member, it sort of raises the issue of how many facilities do we need. But I did want to ask a question in terms of the resource statement that we're going to the NIH grant. I think this went off. Would be phenomenal if you had all these resources that Rusty mentioned in one statement. You'd be hot. No one could compete with that. And so my question is, how are you going to handle NIH grants, and how are you going to handle intellectual property?
Yeah. Well, as you might imagine, we had some thoughts about that in the very beginning, and I'd like to think we came to a reasonable conclusion. We hold no intellectual property. That would have been a food fight from day one. And what we decided is that the consortium members would keep the intellectual property. And in fact, they also do the applications for grants through them. And the other food fight, of course, is indirect cost. And we decided that we would not hold the indirect cost related to those grants. It's created some interesting challenges about how we make the organization work. And we're still resolving some of those issues. But we don't hold intellectual property. And the member institutions put in their own NIH grants.
Well, I think congratulations on that decision. I think that's the best decision to continue to work together. Otherwise, you'd constantly have challenges. And I guess you must have in one of your institutions a place to make cells that can go into humans.
No. So in that regard, actually, we don't have a GMP facility, and we're not planning to. I think JT may want to speak to that, that CIRM is looking, I know, at the possibilities of establishing a GMP facility, one or two, in the state of California. But to take your earlier point, we do hope that the cores that we do build, say like the imaging one, would be available regionally. In fact, we've had some conversations with NIH about ways to collaborate with NCATS and others, as well as with CIRM. But at the moment, we don't have plans to build a GMP facility. Do you want to?
I would just mention that whenever you design something, you have a choice between where you're going to duplicate things and focusing on things where you can be uniquely excellent. And we made the choice not to try to build a GMP setup. There are good ones, as I understand it, at Davis at City of Hope. There are some in the private sector. We're not needed to do that, I think. And so we've really tried to focus on building things where we can bring unique excellence to the table. And so the high-end imaging, the particular collection of investigators, the engineering approaches, those are examples where we thought we could do something unique that would bring value added to not just us, but to the state.
So how many of you actually have been over to the Sanford Consortium building? Oh, quite a few. Well, the rest of you, I endorse what Ed was saying about going over there. Not today.
Come visit.
Stay here today.
Well, you're right.
your question about Northern California, didn't Dick Atkinson say that in his considered judgment, this was about the only place that this sort of thing could have happened? Why did he say that, do you think, Ed?
Well, it's true.
That's true.
Because it happened.
Having lived in Northern California, Southern California, and other parts of the country, I think there is something in the water here, as Larry said, that has made this a more intrinsically collaborative community. Yeah. And someone once said that is maybe one of the reasons, if you think about it, on one border we have a marine base, on another border we have another country, on another border we have a desert, and we have an ocean on the other side. So we're a bit of an island here, and that I think the geographic proximity that puts together these five research institutions, plus the others that are here, have led over the years to a working relationship. Many of the people have been back and forth. Rusty's been a part of another institution. Evan, I know you have an appointment at UC San Diego. There's just historically a lot of interaction and movement back and forth between the institutions that makes it possible to do some of the things here.
Yeah, I also wanted to just, again, footnote the point that you made earlier, Larry, I think, about the architecture involved here, which is we haven't really talked much about.
Yeah.
This building, the Salk, Lou Kahn and Jonas working together on these sorts of things, the architecture is a very important factor in this, isn't it?
But it is. And for those of you who haven't seen it and having lived through the construction of this building, it is really an unusual design to promote interaction. There is a lot of space in the building that's not designated to investigators. So it's not just the conference rooms that are there. There are other types of construction that really promotes the interaction. As Larry said, you basically have to walk through someone else's space to get anywhere in the building. If you want to drink a cup of coffee, you're going to be at two levels interacting with people, the staircases. The walls are made to write on in the building, so that we hope that there will be lots of people, whether they're drinking coffee, grad students, postdocs, who are going to be drawing diagrams on the board, hopefully on the wall, which hopefully we can erase at some point, promote this. The faculty offices are completely glass. So when you're in your faculty office, everybody will know where you are and what you're doing. Right.
No sleeping.
The parking is unique. It's developed in a way to try to allow people from the Mesa to come in and use this. Some of the space is specifically designed for the community to use. We should say a word about that we hope this will be more than just the research institutions that are involved in this. It's a very important part of what we're trying to do, is to make this a community resource, so that the open space, the veranda on the second level, the cafeteria is set up in a way to promote people's interaction.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to reading the stem cell graffiti.
Yeah. I'm not sure I am. But
we're at 10:15, so we're scheduled to take
one comment
break
before
at this point, but we'll go one, over a little
one
bit.
One final thing. Something that I think is really important to emphasize about this experiment that we're involved in is it really has involved a tremendous amount of input from the community, Roger. That's different from any other project that I've been involved in. And obviously, we wouldn't be here if it weren't for CIRM and what they have done. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for Denny Sanford, who made an extraordinary gift, and lent his name, but even more, is actively involved. Our community members, led by Denny and others, are very much involved. And the patient advocates have been an important part of what we're doing, and we look
Malin
forward to
it. Malin Burnham, John Moores as well.
And John, right, and Malin Burnham and Irwin Jacobs. This has been a really community-wide effort, and we're quite excited about it, and thanks for giving us an opportunity to participate today.
Delighted. So we wish we have a 15-minute break now. If you could come back in 15, that would be wonderful. Thank you.